This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Could tougher gun control measures be coming after President Trump says he's willing to consider them? New developments in the Russia probe as another former Trump campaign official pleads guilty to fraud and lying to investigators. And the White House communications director is stepping down. Joining us to discuss these and other top political stories are University of Cincinnati Assistant Professor of Political Science, Dr. David Niven, who's filling in for Howard Wilkinson today, and political junkie Ken Rudin. You can join us, 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Ken, good afternoon. Thank you for joining us. And David, good afternoon to you, too.
Hello, Mark. Hello, David.
It's a pleasure to be with you both, and I'll try to fill in the ample shoes of Howard Wilkinson here.
Hey, Ken, before we get that discussion started, tell us what the trivia question is.
Well, we know that Mike DeWine, who's a former senator, he was defeated in his bid for re-election in 2006, but Mike DeWine is running for governor this year. The trivia question is, who was the last governor of Ohio who, prior to his election, was defeated in a bid for the Senate?
Okay, so who was the last Ohio politician who lost a Senate race before being elected governor? That's what the question boils down to. Is that right?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep, that's it.
If you think you know the answer, give us a call, 513-419-7100. First caller with the correct answer is going to win a political junkie button, 513-419-7100. Again, the first correct caller will win the political junkie button. So, Ken, after every recent mass shooting that we've had in this country, there's been an outcry. You have people calling for either stricter gun laws or more security for vulnerable places like schools. Yet it seems that nothing changes. But do you get a feeling that this time is different? At least that's been my gut feeling. I'm wondering what yours is.
Well, let me tell you what is different. And what is different is that students, as we saw in Parkland, Florida, they said, look, the adults have disappointed us, have failed us all along after Columbine, after Sandy Hook, after other school shootings, plus other shootings in Charleston, South Carolina, when 9 black parishioners were murdered, the slaughter of in the nightclub in Orlando, what happened in Las Vegas a few months ago with 58 people were killed. And every time, you know, the Congress always talks about, well, we've got to do something. And after Las Vegas, they said, well, maybe we should regulate bump stocks, that weapon, that thing that could change a semi-automatic weapon into an automatic weapon. But nothing ever happens. And so these students say, well, you know something? The adults have let us down. We're going to start a mass demonstration similar to what women did or started to do on January 21st, 2017, the day after the inauguration of Donald Trump. It remains to be seen what can be done and what will be done, because I'm not sure how many minds were changed in Congress. Maybe some in Florida were changed because of all the tension that was going on there. But for the most part, I don't see anybody standing up to the NRA. But another thing that's different, which was almost startling, is to watch President Trump just yesterday talk about all these things in a live, nationally televised meeting with Democrats and Republicans, and talking about all these things that are anathema to the NRA and that would please people like Dianne Feinstein and other pro-gun control lawmakers. So what Trump said was shocking. Whether it gets Congress to do something is another question altogether, because most people feel that a lot of what is being proposed would not have stopped the shooter in Florida. Background checks? No. Mental health? No. Did he buy the gun legally? Yes, he did. So other than banning the AR-15s and semi-automatic weapons like that, I don't know what could have stopped it. But the fact that the kids are talking and the fact that President Trump is talking, whether he means it or not, is another thing altogether. But those things make it feel different.
Well, it's also different, though. We've had so many of these horrible incidents, but it didn't lead to Walmart saying they were going to back away at all from the sale of guns. It didn't lead to Dick's Sporting Goods saying that they were going to back away from the sale of assault weapons. So that's a very tangible difference. The fact that the victims are, you know, these children are able to speak. I mean, you know, think about how anonymous, for the most part, the thousands of people who were in that Las Vegas setting became. These students are not that. And then you know, think about the significance to the NRA of the perception that you can never cross them. And you know, I don't even think it's as important what gets done here as what's being chipped away here, which is, you know, the notion that you can never even utter words that the NRA disagrees with and still have a political career. I think that's under great duress right now.
David, how do you think these students are getting through to the lawmakers with their message?
I think where they matter so much is that any student can speak to the system is corrupt, the system is stupid, the system is ill-functioning. And, you know, it's hard to answer that back, you know, in an era where Congress really doesn't get very much of anything done in any direction. You know, but these students can say, what is the point of this policy, and ask it in a way that demands an answer. And, you know, it's startling to imagine these high school students were born after Columbine, and, you know, the notion that there are mass shootings in schools, it has been a part of their lives since they were, you know, since they first set foot on kindergarten day one.
But David, my problem with this is that we've been asking these very same questions, at least since Sandy Hook in 2002. If we're not going to have any kind of action by Congress after the slaughter of 20 first graders, I mean children, in an elementary school, what's going to change? And I understand what's different. And the Walmart and the Dick's Sporting Goods is new. The president speaking up for, you know, somebody who's endorsed by the NRA, having all these proposals yesterday, which is, again, anathema to the NRA. That's new as well. And these kids. But again, until I hear Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell saying, okay, we're going to do something, then things really change. So far, I have not heard that.
Well, you know, I certainly agree that there's a chance that all this ends in a, you know, something of a Trojan horse proposal that's really more about putting more guns in schools than reducing access to guns. But, you know, I think what's really critical here is, you know, this notion that even if you're an insincere NRA supporter, as certainly some people in politics must be, that there was no room for you to say, well, there should be an age minimum. There was no room for you to say there should be real background checks and not background checks with loopholes. I think Trump is offering a lane. Even if he is both an insincere NRA supporter and an insincere supporter of gun limits, I think he's creating a lane for a lot of Republicans who didn't want to march on the NRA's line but found themselves doing it.
And what was interesting, I was just going to say, what was interesting after Trump said what he said, the right wing, the conservative websites on social media, they went, this is not to be, no pun intended, but they went ballistic. The fact is, the headline on Breitbart News said, Trump the gun grabber. I mean, Donald Trump was talking about confiscating guns and taking away from people who maybe have mental illness. I mean, that's exactly what Trump and Republicans were talking about, Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. They would end the Second Amendment. They would confiscate guns. And here we have Donald Trump with his NRA endorsement and all that saying that, you know, we should maybe take away some of these guns from those with mental illnesses. That was so remarkable.
Yeah, I think it was.
Again,
yeah, take them away and then worry about due process later, I think is how he put it.
Later, yes.
You know, I think that's just, you know, that's peak Trump. I mean, that it right. represents the entirety.
Vintage Trump.
Yeah, exactly. It's the entirety of his political arc from somebody. And you know, one of his books has a passage about how he believes in, you know, certain common sense gun reforms. And then he ran as far away as possible from that during the campaign. And now he's stepping back and presumably will run farther away from it again. And, you know, Senator Sass from Nebraska said, you know, Donald Trump's policy is whatever the last person in the room said to him. And certainly
that's so true.
That was the case, you know, in that gun meeting.
Ken, can I give the trivia question again? We've got a couple people online, but let's see if we can get some other folks in on this.
Okay, Mike DeWine, who lost the Senate seat, is now running for governor of Ohio. Who was the last person to lose a Senate seat and then get elected governor of Ohio?
Okay, so last Ohio politician who lost a Senate race and then ended up being elected governor. If you think you know that, 513-419-7100, the number to call. And first correct caller is going to win a political junkie button. So what are the specific things that Trump is agreeing with on the stricter gun law side? I know one of them is, I think he wants to raise the minimum age for buying a rifle is one of the things.
any kind of firearm right from 18 to 21. And the NRA opposes that, and Republicans oppose that. And one of the reasons they oppose it is that, look, you're 18 years old, you're sent overseas to fight for your country, you're using a weapon, and then you come back to this country and you could no longer purchase a weapon. I mean, that's their argument. So in any event, how many of these mass murders have been under 21 years of age? I mean, the person in Parkland was, but most people have not been. So ultimately, I don't know what that affects. If you look at the growing number of slaughters of people with you know, automatic weapons and handguns and things like that, very few have been under 21. And again, if you just raise the limit from 18 to 21, which the NRA strongly opposes, I don't know how many fewer guns that'll be make, you know, result in society. But again, it's something that Republicans and the NRA strongly oppose.
He also, I think he's also said he supports banning bump stocks, the device that was used in the Vegas shooting. I think he says.
And remember what happened after Las Vegas? Speaker Paul Ryan and even the NRA said, you know, we would certainly consider regulating that. And that was 4 or 5 months ago, and nothing happened.
But they considered it, and then they decided against it.
But they just didn't do anything with it. And that's what the fear is, that all this hubbub and all this anger and angst and all the students standing up and saying something must be done. The fear is that it'll disappear once again until the next tragedy.
Yeah, but I do think that there's something different in terms of the NRA has been working this potion for so long, and in each instance, their response to any problem with a gun is, well, the answer to this is more guns. And, you know, I don't think that their power is infinite. Their ability to flex their muscles is infinite. And I think Trump represents an interesting foe for them because, you know, his core political beliefs, you know, are not exactly, you know, etched in granite. And therefore, you know, the kind of influence they would normally exert is in jeopardy. And, you know, I think it's, you know, to your point about, you know, the NRA saying, well, we'll consider this bump stock issue. You know, it's fascinating to see just the evolution of the NRA, even with its current leadership. You know, Wayne LaPierre, after Columbine, said there should be no guns in schools, zero guns in schools. And look where they've come in 20 years to the point where their priority is, of course, more guns in schools.
And while the president is talking about all these restrictions, as we said, raising the age, keeping the guns for mentally ill, talking about the bump stock thing, he even suggested an assault weapons ban that certainly made Dianne Feinstein very happy. But at the same time, you're talking about keeping guns out of schools. The president also said we should arm teachers. Now, right. I don't think anybody thinks that's going to go anywhere, but that's hardly keeping guns out of schools if more and more teachers will have their own guns.
But and we're seeing that here in Ohio with Governor John Kasich is talking about certain gun reforms married to putting more guns in schools, more armed teachers.
And Ken, let's have you give the question again. I've got a couple of people lined up so far to try it. I have you give the question. We'll see if anybody's got it so far.
Okay, Mike DeWine was defeated in his last bid for the Senate and is running for governor this year, who was the last Ohio politician defeated for Senate and later went on to be elected governor.
Okay, let's see if Mike knows the answer to this. Hi, Mike. Who do you think it was?
The late great Jack Gilligan.
Okay, Ken.
Jack Gilligan was defeated in a bid for the Senate in 1968, did go on to be elected governor, but he is not the last one.
Okay, let's see if Karen knows the answer to this. Karen, who do you think it was?
I also thought it was John Gilligan, so I got it wrong.
Thanks, Karen, for trying. Okay, so...
And Jack Gilligan is a good answer. I mean, it's correct. Just not the last one.
We could have let her guess another governor.
No, they have to stick with that first answer.
David, you don't understand the rules here, okay,
yeah.
David?
Okay, let's
Where's
see.
Where's Howard Wilkinson?
Okay, let's see if David knows the answer to this. Hi, David. Hi, David. Who do you think it was?
Dick Celeste.
Dick Celeste.
Dick Celeste actually never ran for the Senate.
Okay. Thanks, David, for trying. So far, we don't have anybody. So if you think you know the answer to that question, again, Ken, if you would give that, and we'll have people try again on this.
Question is, the last person who was defeated in a bid for the Senate who went on to be elected governor.
Okay? 513-419-7100 if you think you know the answer to Ken's trivia question. Also, 513-419-7100 if you'd like to join us in our conversation, and let's talk to George. Hi, George.
Hi. I have a statement that I've been thinking about. This is a very difficult thing about appropriateness of gun ownership and totally different opinions that are dividing our country. And just brainstorming this, my suggestion would be that we either amend or interpret the Second Amendment to be that if you own a weapon of war, that would be any gun that's used by the military, then you are automatically enlisted in your state National Guard for life. And that would be regardless of health, age, or anything else. And the benefits of that would be that it actually fits the concept of militia that's in the Second Amendment. And these people that want to have these guns would have a more certain purpose for having them. They'd have to have training the way National Guard members have training. They'd have to be ready to be called to active duty, but that's what it entails to have a gun like that. And if they
what if you don't comply? What if you don't comply, George? What would be the
same thing for avoiding the draft as at the time we had a draft? But it would be an obligation that puts some credence into why you have to have a gun like that. And if you can't comply, you have the option of giving up the gun, selling it. There'd be a buyback program, something like that. Because I don't see that anything else is going to work. And I just don't understand the paranoia of people that have to have these guns. Like, who is it that they're really worried about coming after them? Members of the opposite party, the Russians, the Chinese, somebody in the other county.
Yeah. All kinds of questions, George. Let's let David and Ken respond to this. Thank you for the call. We really appreciate it.
Well, certainly the word militia and the well-regulated militia that's written into the Second Amendment is kind of the forgotten aspect of the debate. You know, when advocates and the NRA speaks about the Second Amendment, they pretty well erase those words in their interpretation. So, you know, I think the caller is on to something in that, you know, a full reading of the Second Amendment, you know, really places the entire context of the conversation in terms of a militia. And you notice it's very different than the other amendments in the Bill of Rights. You know, it doesn't say, you know, a well-written newspaper being, you know, central to our First Amendment right. You know, there's no caveat or qualification to that. So, you know, I think that's a debate. You know, it's only a very modern interpretation of the Second Amendment that gets us into, you know, personal firearms that one can take, you know, for any purpose at any time.
What would it take to change an amendment or to do away with an amendment? I mean, how difficult is that, David?
Well, I mean, you can amend an amendment just as you can amend any part of the Constitution. You know, we had prohibition as an amendment, and then we amended that amendment. You know, it would either take the consent of, you know, 3/4 of the states or a constitutional convention. So the House, the Senate, and 3/4 of the states, or a constitutional convention, it's a rather high bar to climb, and it isn't feasible at this juncture. The only way it would be feasible would be if a future Supreme Court reined in on Second Amendment rights and you rewrote it in the opposite direction, perhaps.
Kennedy, do you want to weigh in?
Well, the only thing I was thinking of is that, you know, once upon a time, this was really about hunting and sports. And I mean, forget about the well-regulated militia. I think that goes back hundreds of years. It was for the longest time, the NRA was a bunch of hunters and hobbyists. But when distrust of the government grew to such a point where people just felt that they needed guns to protect themselves from their own government, it felt like that you know, the initial reading of the Second Amendment seemed to change drastically. And again, the way David describes the constitutional amendment changing the Constitution in such a way is exactly right. And that's why there's only been, what, 27 amendments to the Constitution because the bar is so high to make it changes.
And the last one took 200 years to pass. So we could propose
not an easy
it now.
Process.
Exactly.
Let's see if we've got anybody who knows the answer to that trivia question. And let's start with Robert. Robert, who do you think it was?
Jim Rhodes.
Jim Rhodes, let's see. Jim Rhodes did run for the Senate, and he was defeated in 1970 by Robert Taft. And he did later get elected governor, but he is not the most recent person to do that.
Okay. Let's see if John knows the answer. Hi, John.
Hi. Yeah, Robert Taft II.
Robert Taft II never ran for governor. He was elected senator in 1970, defeated in 1976. He also ran in 1964 and lost to, let's see, he lost to, who's that old guy? He lost to, but anyway, Taft lost in 64, won in 70, lost in 76, never ran for governor.
Okay, let's see, we have Mike on the line. Mike, who do you think it was?
This is Mike. I thought it was Bob Taft.
I assume we're talking about the son of Mr. Republican, right? If that's what we're talking about, he was a member of Congress, ran for the Senate, was defeated, elected, and defeated again, but never ran for governor.
Okay.
Now, and his son was elected governor, but never ran for Senate.
Okay, and then let's see here. Another Mike. Mike, who do you think it was?
George Voinovich.
George Voinovich is the correct answer. Get that applause.
Very good.
George Voinovich was defeated by Howard Metzenbaum for the Senate in 1988, and 2 years later he was elected governor. In 1990 he was elected governor, and then went on to several terms in the Senate. But George Voinovich is the correct answer.
And Mike, congratulations to you. Stay on the line so that we can get your address so we can find out where to send your prize to. But way to go, Mike. Good job on getting that correctly.
Thank you.
Thank you for calling. Hope Hicks, the White House Communications Director, this is an interesting story because this has been kind of a volatile week for the White House and the administration.
As opposed to the non-volatile weeks.
Yeah. Well, maybe I should say more volatile than usual. That's right, David. Maybe I should put it that way. But we had Hope Hicks resign. What was that, yesterday? She announced she was stepping down?
Yesterday, a day after she testified for 8 hours before the House Intelligence Committee, right?
Right. This was where she made the comment about white lies. And what do you make of this?
Well, you know the old expression, white lies matters. I know that's a terrible joke. But anyway, the point is that Hope Hicks is probably one of the closest people in the administration to Donald Trump. She's a former model who worked for Ivanka Trump. I mean, she was never a political person at all, and suddenly she becomes communications director, and yet she's one of the closest people to Trump. She has his ear. He trusts her very much, but all I know is that apparently she's been telling people several weeks now that she was planning to leave. The fact that she testified on Tuesday for 8 hours before the House Intelligence Committee, when she said that she has to tell white lies sometimes in defense of the president. She was asked about, you know, the Comey resignation, the Trump meeting, the Trump campaign meetings with the Russians. She would not refuse to say anything about that, similar to what Steve Bannon did when he testified. But here it is, you know. And the interesting thing also is she had been dating Rob Porter, the former White House secretary who was forced out or resigned after they found out that he was just beating up his two previous wives. But she's not in the public eye for somebody, the head of communications. Pretty remarkable how invisible she's been, but she was crucial. She was important. Trump trusted her, and now she's soon to leave the White House.
So when does her resignation take effect? Did she say?
I think they said, I think that she didn't say, but I think it's my understanding that it's in the next couple of weeks. And I think there have been more people who have been the White House communications director than people who called in to try to answer the trivia question. I mean, there have been so many. If you think of all of them, Sean Spicer and Scaramucci and all the others, it's just, I think he's had 5 in 13 months or 6 in 13 months, and other presidents have had like 5 in 8 years. So it's a lot of upheaval in the nominee. And this, and it's also bad because she's also close. First of all, it seems to be in the decision made by Chief of Staff John Kelly, who after the Rob Porter fiasco decided to decide, I mean, this is part of what's going on in the White House. The fact that now Jared Kushner has lost his top security clearance, which he never actually had in its entirety. There are a lot of just staff upheavals in the White House that, and these are true Trump loyalists. And the, you know, the fact is that as he's lashing out as his own attorney general, as he's losing people close to him, you could just feel the footsteps of Robert Mueller somehow getting closer and closer.
David, anything you'd like to?
You know, I think what this really is about, you know, normally staff is there to, you know, enhance the president, to add, you know, some solidity to, you know, to make this job, which is all but impossible for one person to do, to make it, you know, to make it workable. And cycling through staff is just another, it's another rung in the inability to keep to any consistent, you know, purpose, to keep to any consistent, you know, set of beliefs. You know, it's just another level of how you can move back and forth on the gun issue or any other issue. The advisors are going to change. And, you know, by the time, you know, the decision is made and before it's implemented, there's an entirely new White House set of folks.
So it's a managerial problem?
It's a managerial crisis around somebody who's a walking managerial crisis. So normally you try to assemble a political staff that helps bring out the best in the leadership and helps create a certain solidity to things. And this is sort of the chaos theory of staffing.
Yeah, and of course
I just want to say I agree completely with David because in many ways Donald Trump is his own communications director. He's his own chief of staff. It's a kind of a very difficult position to take when you have somebody as mercurial and unpredictable as Trump. And I think in many ways, Hope Hicks did a much better job than anybody thought, the fact that she still had his ear and his confidence.
And then you've got the whole thing of Trump criticizing Attorney General Jeff Sessions again. I think earlier he had called him beleaguered. Then he called him disgraceful. And now I think what he's reached, Mr. Magoo level.
Magoo, it's come to that.
It's come to that. I mean, what's this all about?
Well, I think one of the things that's really fascinating about this is, of everyone in the political universe of any standing, Jeff Sessions is perhaps Donald Trump's biggest ally. I mean, this is the first senator to endorse Donald Trump's campaign. This, you know, at the time he jumped on board, this is long before the nomination is settled, you know, he is offering stature and credibility to the campaign. And, you know, he's rewarded by being placed as attorney general. And now not only is Trump antagonizing him, but he's giving him the full, you know, little Marco mocking treatment. I mean, he's now placed him on the political enemies list, and you know, which is all well and good, except he's the Attorney General of the United States.
Donald Trump has never forgiven him for recusing himself in the Russian investigation, and once his own Attorney General recused himself, that led to Rod Rosenstein, the Deputy Attorney General, that led him to pick somebody by the name of Robert Mueller as a special counsel to investigate it. So every time there's another indictment, like with Rick Gates or Paul Manafort or George Papadopoulos or Michael Flynn or anybody like that, Donald Trump always thinks that if it weren't for my own attorney general who recused himself, there would be no Robert Mueller. So every time something bad happens, every time there's an issue about referring something to the inspector general, every time there's an issue about, well, why aren't we investigating Hillary Clinton and the Democrats? He always blames Jeff Sessions. It's remarkable how much stuff he, the attorney general, has taken from the president. I've never, ever seen such abuse from a president to his own member of his cabinet. And the fact that Jeff Sessions has not resigned is pretty remarkable. But if he does fire him, if the goal of all this is for Sessions to leave, and if he doesn't leave, that Trump fires him, do you think that the Senate would go along and confirm a lackey as his attorney general? Do you think that Robert Mueller will not be watching the fact that Jeff Sessions is being fired because he didn't, you know, thoroughly align himself with the Trump point of view. This is a fascinating case study of how an administration implodes, and never before have I seen it with somebody's own attorney general. I mean, we did see it with Watergate, and Nixon did fire Elliot Richardson, or Elliot Richardson resigned during the Saturday Night Massacre rather than fire Archibald Cox. But there wasn't this abuse, this ridiculing you see from the president to the attorney general. That's the part that's just mind-boggling.
Well, not only was there not all that abuse, but this would be more akin to Nixon taking on John Mitchell. I mean, this is a Trump guy. This is just somebody who happened upon the office of attorney general. And I think one of the interesting angles to this is it really suggests the standard for loyalty for Trump is being willing to face prosecution and not saying anything, because clearly Sessions was in a bind for having not disclosed his Russian meetings during the confirmation hearing. So he was in a bind himself. He can't put his fingerprints on the Russian investigation without implicating himself. So the standard then from Trump to the cabinet and anybody else in the administration is, it's you, not me. And clearly that's the box Sessions is in. And it is fascinating that he's still in this office, despite now being called Mr. Magoo.
Yeah, I think his response, he gave a very professional response to what the president said. Then he met with two of his top deputies today. So I guess he's just saying, I'm here, I'm staying, I'm not going anyplace.
He spoke of his integrity and his honesty and the grand irony of all this is, this is a person who Democrats regard as something just short of a Klansman, and now he's going to be held in high regard as having stood up to Donald Trump.
Ken,
exactly,
go ahead.
Right. And when he talked about that integrity and honesty, that's what Trump blew up at that. Like, how dare you respond to me? I mean, I can call you disgraceful. I can call you a loser. I can call you Mr. Magoo. But responding by talking about integrity and honor, that's crossing a line.
In a polite, civil way. Imagine that. Ken, you'd mentioned Rick Gates, former top campaign official to President Trump. What happened with him? He's the latest official to plead guilty, isn't he, in the whole Russia probe?
Yes, and of course he was also Paul Manafort's partner. Now I don't know what Rick Gates has to do or what he might know about Russian collusion with Trump campaign officials. It doesn't seem like that's part of the investigation. But what Robert Mueller seems to be doing is going after everybody who has some closeness with the president or the campaign or the administration. And Rick Gates, in many ways, is even closer than Manafort, because Paul Manafort was lasted as campaign chair for about 4 months in 2016, whereas Rick Gates lasted longer than that through the transition and even into the early parts of the presidency. And he knows a lot of stuff. He certainly knows a lot of stuff about Manafort. There's a lot of pressure on Paul Manafort to testify, even though Manafort pleaded not guilty, I guess, yesterday. So in other words, they're trying to go after everybody who has some kind of closeness to the president, and trying to just, wrangle some kind of deals and understanding of what's going on. It's not something the president wants to hear. It just shows that for all the distractions and all the things going on, Robert Mueller is not being deterred. He's going full steam ahead. Again, the question is, how close is he getting, and how long will he stay in this job, given Donald Trump's propensity for getting rid of people who he displeases him.
What did you think of the indictments against the 13 Russians? How significant do you think that was?
I think it's part of it. I mean, I think that in many ways that's even more significant, because remember, it was Russians whom Manafort and Eric Trump and Jared Kushner met in Trump Tower in 2016. They talked about their official line was, we want to talk about Russian adoption policy, when everybody knows what they were doing was peddling information about Hillary Clinton. And if that's not collusion with Russians to talk about the campaign, then I don't know what is. But the Russians, if the story is obstruction of justice, if the story is financial ties that Trump and Trump Industries may have with Russia, the indictment of the 13 Russians is big as well.
And did I understand this correctly, too, that these 13 particular Russians, it wasn't just Donald Trump. They were also trying to help, I think, Bernie Sanders and Jill Stein, if I heard correctly. And it was kind of an anybody but Hillary thing.
Well, it is fascinating, the tentacles of this. and, you know, try to understand the motivations of the Green Party and then think about a foreign influence of the Green Party and the ironies of you know, trying to influence an election through the Green Party. And yet, you know, this is a part of the story. And you really get a sense of what they were up to when you see the evidence that in some cases they were plotting to encourage counter demonstrations against their own demonstrations. So they were plotting, you know, a demonstration on one side of the street for one issue and a demonstration on the opposite side of the street for the other side of that issue. And you get a sense of the kind of tumult and turmoil that they were trying to set loose on the American people.
And when you watch the testimony of people like Mike Rogers of the NSA and Dan Coats, you know, all the intelligence agencies, they're saying what Russia is just having a field day, doing what they can to disrupt U.S. elections. That's continuing in 2018 and most likely into 2020 as well. And when they're asked by, well, what is the administration doing? What instructions are you getting? What instructions are you getting from the administration to combat this? They say we've gotten nothing from them. There's no directives coming from the White House or the president or anybody like that to counteract this. And I think that is the most disturbing and upsetting thing of all of that.
Do either of you get a sense that Robert Mueller is drawing near the end of his investigation, or you think that this is just the beginning? David's smiling.
So. I don't even think we're at the end of the beginning, as Churchill would put it. The comprehensiveness with which he's going after things and the Gates plea is really interesting when you get at what he is pleading guilty to most recently. It's lying after the indictments came down. So this isn't corruption from, you know, years back. They were still trying to put the story together and weren't able to do it. That's what he accepted the plea on. And so Gates goes down. Presumably, the only way he can reduce his jail time is to give everything he knows about Manafort, puts Manafort in worse water to put the heat on Manafort to give up as much as possible. I don't think we're even near the end. I think Robert Mueller is putting together the book of the world on this case.
I agree with David completely. Remember, Mueller was only in office in this position since April. And when you think of the Watergate thing between the break-in in June of 72 and the resignation of Richard Nixon, that was 2 years later. So we don't even have a year of the Mueller investigation. There's a lot to go and a lot to uncover.
Ken, the indictment of the 13 Russians, I mean, how likely is it that any of these Russians are going to be prosecuted at all?
Probably none. I mean, certainly Moscow is not going to give them up. And of course, when you asked Putin about what's going on, he said, oh, there's absolutely nothing to it. It's just so remarkable to me that once again, you always see the president of the United States berating and degrading our allies. We see it with South Korea. We see it with Mexico. We even see it with Canada. We see it with Britain and France and West Germany regarding trading issues. But criticism of Putin, criticism of Russia, criticism of things like that, you just don't see it. And it seems pretty transparent to me, and I've already given all my thoughts to Robert Mueller, and he can do with it what he wants.
It does seem unlikely that any of the 13 are going to choose to vacation at Disney World this year.
David, how much all the meddling they're accused of doing?
Or Mar-a-Lago.
Even better.
All the meddling they're accused of doing, how much of an impact did that really have on the election? I mean, do we really know?
I don't think we can ever know, but, you know, I mean, here's how I would put it. We created a society perfectly susceptible to this, and they took advantage of it. So, you know, they successfully came to realize that we would perpetuate any message, no matter how absurd, that we would debate any topic, no matter how absurd, that our elections are not exactly, questions between, Socrates and Plato and who's smarter. And so we opened this for them, and they helped foment it. Now,
you think the goal was more to distract and create turmoil than anything else?
I think it was certainly to create turmoil, to create uncertainty. And, you know, I don't think we can overstate the significance of the window of opportunity. You know, the fact that there was this thing called a Hillary Clinton email scandal, meant anything associated with her and email created a scandal story, no matter what was in the email. It could have literally been, here's what I'm going to have for dinner. It would have you know, generated more scandal stories. So, you know, sort of like a Petri dish situation where we created all the ingredients and they put a little droplet in and, you know, on it went from there.
Yeah.
But in fairness, Hillary Clinton didn't help her cause either. No. With so many meandering answers to what those email scandals were about and those deleted stuff. And so, I mean, talk about taking advantage of a situation. One, you had Donald Trump, who was so pliable, and Hillary Clinton, who just did not give coherent answers to what was going on. It was the perfect storm.
In Senate news, Mitt Romney running for the open Senate seat in Utah. You think this is going to mean that he and Trump are now best friends?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I was just thinking of Bob Corker, the senator from Tennessee, who was endorsed Donald Trump in 2016. And then when he announced he wasn't running again, became a harsh critic of Donald Trump. And then in recent weeks, when he said he was thinking of running again, you know, changing his mind and running for reelection, he started to cozy up to Trump again. And then, of course, he announced 2 days ago that, no, I'm not going to run after all. I don't think so. I think Mitt Romney does have the capacity for independence. We saw it when he was governor of Massachusetts. We saw it for a brief time when he was running for the presidency in 2012 and 2008. Of course, for all the criticism he gave of Donald Trump, you know, he said he's just ill-fitted and ill-tempered and just the wrong guy for the job. He also did kind of like put his head between his legs and say, I would love to be Secretary of State, and that went nowhere. I don't think he'll be outspoken like maybe Donald Trump, I'm sorry, like John McCain or Jeff Flake, but I think he can be an independent voice in the Senate, and the Republican Party desperately needs that, because right now there is really nobody. Lindsey Graham sounds like he's a critic one day, and then he's his best friend golf buddy the next day. Romney is the kind of voice that the Republican Party desperately needs if there's any, you know, honor and dignity to the party in this era of Donald Trump.
Well, you know, I agree that you know, Romney has taken every side of Donald Trump, just as Donald Trump takes every side of an issue. I mean, at times, Romney has denounced him very, very forcefully. But then Trump announces that he's endorsing Romney for the Senate, and Romney welcomes his support. So, you know, I think he probably is going to fill in that Lindsey Graham role, where he's occasionally a critic, but then, you know, on another issue is cozying up to him.
Ken, I hear that there is another Sanders who's going to run for Congress. In this case, it's Levi Sanders, son of yeah. Bernie Sanders. He's going to be running where? It's New Hampshire District?
Right, yes.
Yeah?
Yes, that's correct. That's a seat that one of the Democratic incumbent is leaving, yes.
That first district, if I understand correctly, is one of the swingiest districts. I mean, they went for Trump in 2016. They went for Barack Obama in 2012. And they've just kind of gone back and forth between Democrat and Republican over the years.
Yeah, especially in that House seat as well. It's a very swing district. It's Manchester, New Hampshire. It's you know, you'll have a Republican. You have a Bass. Mr. Bass has run several times, and then he was beaten and then reelected. It keeps going back and forth. And I don't know if Levi Sanders is going to win the Democratic nomination, but I'm just trying to think. You know, I don't think you ever see the son of a presidential candidate running for office before. Oh, wait, the Bushes. What am I thinking? I mean, we don't have enough dynasties in this country. Am I talking to somebody who lives in Taft country? But, you know, something. It'll be interesting to see if he can win that thing.
Yeah, he doesn't live in the district, is my understanding, too. Is that going to cause him a problem?
Well, all he has to do is live in the state. I mean, he doesn't have to live in the district. And sometimes we see with redistricting that the folks in the state capital are to defeat an enemy or a perceived enemy, they'll deliberately draw a district that excludes a guy's house. And like they'll just, you know, cut out. I mean, it's amazing what they do with redistricting. I don't think it matters. You could always move into the district later. We know that Mitt Romney didn't live in Utah until he decided to move there. We know that Hillary Clinton didn't live in New York until she decided to move there. So these things have Bobby Kennedy lived in New York. Matter of fact, when Bobby Kennedy was running for the Senate in New York in 1964. The Republican incumbent, Kenneth Keating, gave Kennedy a roadmap to New York and just to let him know what New York was like. So, you know, you don't have to live in the district, but of course, that is an issue that the opponents will mention.
You know, I think a bigger issue for him, this will sound familiar, is that Levy Sanders has a tweeting problem. He had a long series of tweets.
So I mispronounced his name.
Yes.
Now. Okay,
yeah,
Levy.
It's Levy. But in any case, he has some tweets that pro-Confederate flag and some things that aren't going to square very well in the Democratic primary in the first district. And so I don't know that he's really going to be a serious candidate. But to be fair, Bernie Sanders started his career with a long series of ill-considered campaigns where, you know, he would get 2 and 3% of the vote. So he might be following his father's footsteps that way.
He would run exactly right. He would run on the Liberty Union Party, which is a fringe group in Vermont. And he would run against the Democratic nominee, get 2%, 3%. Then miraculously, he was elected mayor of Burlington. And he would still lose as an independent, and he still is an independent. Remember, even when he ran against Hillary Clinton, he refused to join the Democratic Party. He's still not a member of the Democratic Party. And yet, he's a likely candidate in 2020 when he's going to be, I think, 117 years old, which reminds me of what happened with Dianne Feinstein last weekend in California. She's 84 years old, running for another term, and she got booed at the state convention because she's still not progressive enough. This is a woman who has spent her whole career fighting for tough gun laws and everything, but she doesn't support single payer. She's, you know, she said that we should give Donald Trump a chance, and you can't say that to angry activists in this era of Trump. So she got clobbered at the state convention. She'll probably still win the nomination on June 5th and probably get reelected in November. But it's amazing that even somebody like Dianne Feinstein is not seen as progressive enough by certain wings of the Democratic Party.
If Levy were to win, Ken, would it mean anything for a presidential bid for his father in 2020?
I don't think so. I mean, I don't even know if it would help. I just know that the Democrat, you know, you talk about Donald Trump's numbers are still in many polls under 40%. You're saying, how in the world can he get reelected in 2020? Well, the Democratic Party is going to have to put up somebody who can win. I am not convinced that Bernie Sanders is somebody who could win a national election. I mean, yes, he'll win Vermont, and he may win California, New York, and even Illinois, but is he going to win, you know, the tough states that Donald Trump took away from Hillary Clinton in 2016? I'm not convinced of it. The Democratic Party has a lot of soul-searching to do before we start talking about 2020.
Ken and David, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, guys, and David, great to meet you.
Hey, it was my pleasure, Ken.
Political junkie Ken Rudin and University of Cincinnati Assistant Professor of Political Science, Dr. David Niven. Thanks for listening to this podcast of Cincinnati Edition. The producer was Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer was Selena Reeder. Josh Elstro was the technical director. I'm Mark Haney.